as for the change of the title, I was supposed to be talking about the second part of quantization of the Gaudi models, but I felt that Guillermo had done such a good job that there was no point in talking about something that was already taken care of by him. So I decided to change the title and talk more about something which is closer to loop quantum gravity, I think, and this is the reason for the new title. So what is the motivation for this work? Go to transparency 2, please. So this idea, which is rather old, to consider isolated horizons, is motivated by the necessity of characterizing black holes in equilibrium. And then the question then and now is, what are the quantum horizon states that implement this? And if one wants to compute entropy, then the natural question is, what states within this formalism should we count? And then a question is also, when we count the states, what is the relation between entropy and area, say? What is the behavior of the entropy function? These are questions which are not new. They have been, in fact, asked for several years now within the isolated horizon formalism. And the motivation for this work was to consider a different regime, so to speak, because all the computations previously were done in the large area limit, doing some approximations on the countings. And from there, we could get the main term, which was linear, and some corrections. But not much was known about what happens when we consider very small black holes at the Planck regime. So the part of the motivation was to go and look at this part of the theory, so to speak. And then there are several new questions that arise in this regime. For instance, is the domain of applicability of the model also these small black holes? After all, we started normally, or everything was justified by taking the large area limit, because we started from something which was rather classical. So the question is, can we still apply the same model to very small black holes, and do we get any sensible or any interesting results out of it? Next slide, please. So the plan of the talk is as follows. I'll tell you a little bit of the history of how this idea developed, just to put it in proper perspective. Then we have to go to the classical preliminaries, which is the isolated horizons. I will remind you a little bit about what is the quantum horizon geometry. And then we will go and describe a little bit about what is the counting and what should be the entropy. This is basically a reminder for all of you who are not completely familiar with all these procedures. There's nothing new here. The only thing rather new is the last part, which is what we find by counting directly states of small black holes. Next slide. So the history goes back to 94 when Lee and Carlo found the spectrum of the area operator. And then it was not long after that Kirill and Carlo started considering punctures of a two-dimensional horizon with a spin network, say, as degrees of freedom which we could count and then account for the entropy of the black holes. At that time, it was not very clear exactly what conditions should be asked to these states, to these quantum states, so that we can count states corresponding to the presence of a horizon. And for that, it was needed to have a formalism, which was understood in 97, the isolated horizons. And it was a couple of years later, more or less, that all the quantum geometry of the horizon was fully understood in terms of precise, detailed analysis of the quantum theory. And that seemed to be like the end of the story, but there was some couple of unexpected things. There was some possible relation between entropy and quasi-normal modes, which was discovered by Olaf Dreyer in 2002. That was interesting for a while, but then the people at Warsaw discovered a couple of years later that the original entropy calculation of Ashtekar, Baez, and Krasnov had a mistake, and there was a new counting which was proposed at the time, and that was not the only one. There were several new counting starting in late 2004 and then 2005, and by now we have at least four or five different and competing analytical countings.
Excuse me, this is Jurek from Warsaw. Can I clarify?
Sure.
So the meaning of this phrase new counting is different in relation to our work, DLM, and different in the next line. So in our case, this was just the original, it was just recounting of Ashtekar, Baez, Krasnov entropy, whereas the next line, these new countings are just new models, or in other words, people propose different set of states, different definition of state of black hole, and they count their new state. So this is my clarification.
Okay, thank you. So I will come back to this clarification of Jurek later on. So let me just go ahead and just go to the next slide, please. Okay, so the physical motivation is to describe black holes which are in equilibrium, and the only thing that is important to be in equilibrium is the horizon itself. So the original question is, can we implement these conditions by means of boundary conditions? And the answer was given precisely by the isolated horizon boundary conditions, which are imposed on an inner boundary of the region under consideration. That is, we are, in effect, cutting all the interior of the would-be black hole. We are only considering the exterior region and the space-time which is outside. And of course, there are many questions about this. The first one is this a physical boundary? And the answer is no, because we expect that in space-time there will be an interior region. In fact, many of the new developments in black holes, which are very exciting, are precisely taking into account the interior region and seeing what happens in the singularity. But in this formalism, we are cutting that region out, and we are somehow expecting that the existence of this boundary with its boundary conditions will capture in a way the information or some part of information that is left out, that is in the interior of the black hole. The question is then, what is the physical interpretation of this boundary? The next slide. So the boundary, which we call delta, is a three-dimensional space-time object, which is, as I say, will provide an effective description of the degrees of freedom in the inside region. Now, the inside region is outside the region we are considering, but is what we normally would call the inside region of the black hole itself. And the nice thing is that one only it's not that we are only considering geometric boundary conditions, which we do. These boundary conditions turn out to be such that the variational principle is consistent. That means we can talk about the variational principle and then Hamiltonian description. And the interpretation in the quantum theory is that whatever degrees of freedom in the horizon, which when they become quantum or when we quantize them, are those that are responsible for the entropy of the horizon. And there will be some entropy that we will associate to the two-dimensional, which we also call the horizon, but now it's a two-dimensional object, which is the intersection of the three-dimensional hypersurface with the also three-dimensional null isolated horizon. There are all sorts of interpretational issues about this entropy we are assigning. And for instance, there's this whole discussion about which is the, what are we associating the entropy to? Is it degrees of freedom which are contained in the horizon that we don't see? Is there some holographic principle in action here? Now, this cannot be precisely holographic because we are cutting out the interior region anyway. And can we think of the entropy as some type of entanglement entropy between interior or exterior, or not interior, but the horizon with the exterior region? So there are all sorts of questions which are, to my mind, not completely settled, and also, but that can be also discussed. Next slide, please. So just to remind very quickly the classical part of what isolated horizons are, and the main features of the definition. So we say that an isolated horizon is a null three-dimensional surface, is non-expanding, and there are many subtleties here, but roughly speaking, one has some notion of translational symmetry along the horizon, the generators of the horizon. And from these specifications or these requirements, there are three main consequences which are relevant for our discussion here. The first one is that all the degrees of freedom classically at the horizon will be captured by a U1 connection, that is in this case a one form, which is the pullback of the gravitational connection contracted with an unit radial vector, which is somehow intuitively radial to the two-dimensional surface we are considering, and that is what we call W here. And another very important issue is that the total symplectic structure of the theory is now going to contain two parts. The first part is the bulk part, which is the ordinary symplectic structure. And this result is true for any matter couplings that have been considered so far, which means that the symplectic structure of the bulk could contain the gravitational part and the Maxwell, Young-Mills, and scalar field and whatever. And there will be, which is the important part here, a contribution from the horizon, which has the following form, and which is this, in this equation. And this is precisely the symplectic structure one would get from a Chern-Simons theory, or a U1 Chern-Simons theory on the horizon. Now we see that this connection W, which was the pullback of the original connection, now it doesn't commute with itself on the horizon, which means that we cannot take the ordinary quantization, let's say in terms of spin networks or something like that, and just restrict those to the horizon. We have to do something else, because now the connection becomes non-commuting. And the last relation that I'm interested here is one that connects the curvature of this U1 connection, which is the FAB on the last equation on the left-hand side. And the right-hand side is this triad, the gravitational part, which is also contracted with this radial vector. And they are related by some number which has to do with the value of the classical area, which is A0 of the isolated horizon we started with. In this variational principle, everything starts from the assumption that there is this internal boundary to which we assign possible many multiples, but in the simplest case of spherical horizons, which I will consider here, the only number we have to specify from the beginning is the area, which is this A0 that appears in these two last equations. This last condition, which I will call the horizon constraint, is relating an object which is intrinsic to the horizon, which is the curvature of the U1 connection, with some object which is somehow knows about the bulk part of the phase space. At least that will be, even when classically this is everything, is just a pullback of the bulk field. In the quantum theory, there will be a distinction which is important, because one part will pertain to the horizon Hilbert space, and the other one will be part of the bulk Hilbert space. And here is part of this issue that Jurek was pointing out that merits some consideration later. Next slide. Okay, so these are the consequences. Previously, we had the consequences of the boundary conditions on what the main fields are, that we have to take into account for describing the horizon. And then the second question is what happens with the constraints of the theory. We know that the theory tells us through the Hamiltonian analysis which motions on phase space or canonical transformations are to be regarded as gauge, those generated by the constraints, and which are not, we will have ordinary canonical transformations generated by some Hamiltonian function. In this case, when one does the classical analysis in detail, we see that with regarding the three main constraints, we have the Gauss's law, of course, which is in this case equivalent to the last equation of the previous transparency, which was this relation between curvature and triad, that is, has all the content of the Gauss's law at the horizon. So if we impose that condition, then we are assuring that we are in the gauge invariant sector. Diffeomorphisms now will be that leap, the two-dimensional surface invariants are going to be gauge. That means that the vector fields that generate them have to be tangent to S. So whenever we consider quantum theory, we have to look and implement this condition in the quantization. And in the last point, it turns out that the scalar constraint is such that the lapse has to vanish at the horizon, at the two-dimensional horizon, which means that the scalar constraint leaves the horizon untouched. That means it doesn't do anything to the horizon. And in particular, this means that anything that would be generated by something like the constraint is not going to be regarded as gauge, but rather as a canonical transformation generated by a true Hamiltonian. So we don't have to impose anything like a scalar constraint on the horizon. And this also implies that any gauge and diffeomorphism invariant observable on the horizon will be naturally a Dirac observable of the full theory. So these three facts that are giving us given to us by the constraints, we have to implement in a way in the quantum theory. Okay, so next slide. Okay, so the quantum theory, one normally takes a viewpoint that given that on the classical level there was a splitting of the phase space, roughly speaking, into bulk and the horizon parts, and mainly because there was also the splitting of the eclectic structure in the bulk part and the surface contribution that only comes over the gravitational part. One is then naturally led to consider as the total kinematical Hilbert space the tensor product of the volume Hilbert space, which is the left part of the first equation, and tensor with the Hilbert space of the surface associated to the horizon. And I will not give a precise construction of this, but roughly speaking, we can think of the horizon Hilbert space as built from Chern-Simons Hilbert spaces for a sphere with punctures. We saw that the symplectic structure that was induced on the for the connection on the horizon is that of Chern-Simons theory. So we expect that some quantization which knows about this symplectic structure will be of this type. The fact that we have spin networks piercing the horizon and introducing punctures on it then naturally leads us to consider the Hilbert spaces of Chern-Simons theory on a two-dimensional sphere with punctures. I will focus on the first condition that we had at the classical theory, because there's only two conditions now to be taken care of, Gauss's law and diffeomorphisms. So the first one, which is Gauss's law, is equivalent to imposing this condition, which is the second equation on this transparency, which is called the horizon quantum condition. And this basically is relating, is asking that there be a relation between the action of the curvature, which acts on the surface part of the Hilbert space. This is to call it the connection of the U1, the curvature of the U1 connection on the horizon, and the other 10, which acts on the other part, which acts on the bulk part of the volume part of the Hilbert space, is basically the Trias field at the horizon. So this condition, which is relating two separate parts of the tensor product Hilbert space, is what we will ask for states to be considered as quantum states of an isolated horizon. States have to satisfy this condition if they are going to be considered as states representing this physical Hilbert space of a horizon with a given area. And this condition of settling was, we can call it the quantum horizon condition, and that has to be satisfied by states. Okay, so next slide. Okay, so if we now have the horizon condition and the quantum state that we are going to consider, the natural question was, how do we compute now entropy? So we have to ask, okay, so what do we mean by computing entropy? Entropy of what? So again, since at the classical level we started with an isolated horizon of a given fixed area A naught, and we kept all the way to the quantization this number. So the question we are asking is, we now consider this quantum theory, which whose states are representing the existence of an isolated quantum isolated horizon now with this classically assigned area A naught. The question is now, how many states in this quantum theory satisfy all the conditions that we are asking, so that we can consider them as microstates that represent the macrostate that we started with, namely the horizon of given area.
Alex, can you clarify something? Because obviously, when you say state, you have to say states in what? I mean, if you look at states in your full Hilbert space, then the number of such states is likely to be infinite, just because there are all these bulk states in which can represent other matter fields or gravitational radiation outside, well separated from the horizon. So what do you mean by this n? What is this number of states? In what Hilbert space are we calculating? Is it a surface state? Is it the total Hilbert space, or what?
Thank you. Yes, that's an important point. These are states that are supposed to be on the full Hilbert space, but as I was pointing out, there would be an infinite number of different bulk states which would have the same boundary or the same horizon states. So one normally what one does is to ignore these different volume states, or we can take a trace over the volume part of the state. So basically we are only looking at horizon states, and this is the state we are going to consider. So we are going to restrict to the Hilbert space of the surface and then count states there. And then, of course, this comes from a procedure in which we are taking the trace over the volume degrees of freedom. Otherwise, we would get infinity. Okay, so with this clarification, we're taking and considering only surface states. And the conditions we are going to ask to these states that they should satisfy are motivated by some microcanonical viewpoint, which is that we are fixing this classical number, which is the area, A naught. So we are going to consider only those states, quantum states, that are in a very, in a small neighborhood around this classical value, A naught. And this is the first condition. So we ask that the expectation value of the area operator lies in this interval. We're going to ask that the state satisfy what I call the quantum horizon condition. And then if we count all the states that satisfy these two conditions, and apart from that, we also have to implement diffeomorphism constraint, which we haven't done, then in that case, we do get a finite dimensional Hilbert space of those states, if we count this dimensionality, then we get this number n, and then the entropy we will associate to the horizon will be the logarithm of that number. So the main challenge in all this is to identify exactly those states that satisfy these conditions and to count them, and this is part of what Jurek was referring to, that there is some, not debate, but let's say confusion about exactly which states we should be counting that satisfy these conditions. Next slide. So there's a convenient way of characterizing the states, and this uses precisely what we know from the volume Hilbert space, which is that spin networks are convenient in this sense. That means that we have a spin network on the bulk part, which may end at the horizon. This creates a puncture, and then we can associate to the puncture the label that was given to the edge of the spin network that touched the horizon. In this case, it will be a J, which is a half integer. So we will have, from this perspective, the states would be on the surface, would be punctures, or would be labeled by punctures, which on itself have the labeled J coming from the from spin network. Now these labels J, they are there because they will be responsible for the area we will associate to the entropy to the horizon through the ordinary standard formula that is there. And this is, so we can think of this as the area that is given to the horizon by the volume quantum theory. Probably we would like at some point to have an intrinsic definition of area, which wouldn't be exactly this one. But if we take the viewpoint that we are somehow endowing the horizon with the area coming from the bulk part, then we have to take and consider the labels J for the punctures. Now, is there any other quantum number that we can associate to this? And the answer is yes, because there is this other operator, the trial operator, that has its eigenvalues are also half integers, which we call mi, and this is very much like projection of the angular momentum in some direction, which can be half integers, and they start from minus absolute value of j up to plus absolute value of j, and these numbers have the interpretation of, through the quantum boundary condition, they are related to information about the geometry on the horizon through the holonomies, because roughly speaking, they will be associated with the holonomies of this connection around the punctures. So they do have information, intrinsic information to the horizon, and there will be further restriction or condition on these numbers, on the states that we have to consider, and this is that the sum of the numbers mi should be zero. And this condition comes from something, the quantum equivalent of imposing that the sphere has the horizon has the topology of a two-sphere. And then that imposes this new constraint, which is that the sum of the m's has to be zero. We'll call this the total projection condition or total projection constraint. So to summarize, we have punctures, and for each puncture there is a label j and there's a label m. And we have to count how many of those punctures with labels we have that satisfy the conditions we are asking, namely that the area be in this small neighborhood around the classical value, and that this new projection condition, the sum over m's, vanishes. Okay. So next slide. Okay, so filling this puncture has, to each puncture there is a J and there is an M. And then the question is, if we want to count, we don't want to overcount. And also we have to somehow implement or consider diffeomorphisms into the picture, because we could have, for instance, 7 punctures on the sphere, which are in a given point of the 2 sphere, and another 7 punctures with the same labels some other place. And we want to ask, are these 2 states equivalent? Because intuitively we could think that there is a diffeomorphism that moves one of the configurations to the other configuration, and we should expect that if we want states to be invariant on their diffeomorphisms, then somehow we have to identify many of these states that we have. And the answer is yes, there is a way of identifying states which kinematically are different, and this is a very subtle point on the formalism. And to my mind, this was clarified in the original paper by Abai, John, and Kirill. And this is the viewpoint we should consider here. And basically, we have to consider only, or the punctures we are going to consider are only dependent of how many punctures we do have. That means that we can think of moving punctures around with diffeomorphisms in such a way that we can identify them. And there is a specification of how to relate the labels, or how to see whether the labels of the punctures are to be identified or not. And the end question after this analysis, which I will not go into the details, is that if the punctures have the same labels, a couple of punctures, say, have the same label J and M, then we cannot distinguish those states. For instance, if there were 2 punctures only with the same labels, and so we have to consider them as indistinguishable and not count them. And we shouldn't count them twice then.
Can I interrupt?
Sure.
Okay, so there is a lot to clarify. Let me start from the most general clarification. So the punctures actually are not sets of punctures, but sequences. So they are ordered. The order somehow comes from the Chern-Simons theory. After we average with respect to the diffeomorphism, then we still don't get rid of this ordering. So in fact, we deal with sequences of the labels rather than sets of labels. So regardless of what we count, we should count sequences of labels. And now, according to this original Ashtekar by Krasnov model, what we count are the labels M. So we drop the labels J, and we count all the possible sequences of the labels M, such that there exist labels J, such that the corresponding bulk state contributes area required classical area. Okay, and as far as I understand, I guess that in according to this counting which you are proposing, you want to count sequences of pairs, J's and M. Which is also a well-defined proposal, but it's not really what was proposed by Ashtekar, Baez, and Krasnov in their original work. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I think the clarification by Jurek in terms of order punctures is relevant. It is true that we have to consider the punctures as order. I think there is some confusion, at least confusion in the sense that Jurek and I haven't been able to clarify this point of exactly what was that Ashtekar, Baez, and Krasnov were counting. My reading of the paper is that they were counting J's and M's, and that is precisely the point of the first clarification of Jurek, whether there was a new counting or not. But if we take the viewpoint here that we should look at these two numbers, J's and M's, then everything that that will follow is then the consequence. There is this other counting of Jurek in which, and collaborators in which they consider only M's, and the result is slightly different, but I think we shouldn't go into much more details here other than this. So I will just continue with this description and consider both labels J and M.
I mean, this Abhay, since we're talking about a mistake in a paper, so let me just say that I think the quantum horizon geometry of that paper is perfectly fine. There's no dispute about that at all. As far as I'm concerned, it certainly is true that in the counting of the final counting states section, there was an error. Now, we do say explicitly, I think, but if we did not, then this is what we definitely meant, that we are really counting the surface states. In other words, what we had in mind was really calculating the thing that Jurek just mentioned, calculating just the M levels. So, first of all, there's ordering, and then we just calculate these M levels. The reason is because the Chern-Simon states are just labeled by M's, not by J's. And we wanted to count just the Chern-Simon states, which are supposed to be the surface states. I think it is sort of a red herring to go into the discussion about where exactly the errors were in this paper when we are counting things, at what step it happened, and so on. Because anyway, we're talking about an error, so I think we should just drop that whole discussion, and we can just say, well, what was intended, and go on from that. But as both Jurek and Alexa clarified, Jurek was actually doing the correct counting. I shouldn't say Jurek, the whole Warsaw group was doing the correct counting of what we wanted to count, that is to say Ashtekar, Baez, and Krasnow. Whereas now the proposed counting of Alex and other people is basically something different. I'm not saying that they're wrong or something, but that is not what we had in mind.
Okay, thank you, Baez, for the clarification. So just to further clarify this, what we think we are counting with this is not what they have in mind, but is what they would have gotten were not this for this mistake, which was basically algebraic mistake in the counting at the last part. But as my reading of the paper, if I follow what the paper says, which is not, maybe not what they meant, but what it says, this would be the counting. I wouldn't like to call any of these countings the correct one, because I think there is still something there to be understood. So with that in mind, let me continue with the next slide. And I should say that most of the results that come here are somewhat irrelevant to this discussion. I mean, because there will be small deviations, I think, but most of the behavior that we will see when counting directly is not going to be affected by this. Okay, so now the counting that we did, which was direct, which is we start now with a very small black hole, because we are going to count using computers. That means that we don't have the capacity of counting many states, and we will do directly the counting by asking and implementing these two conditions. And we just tell the computer how to compute the states, and we do that for for many values of the area A naught, and then we can once we have this, we can then ask many questions and start varying several of the numbers we have to play with, and then the questions that come in when asking this. Implementing this counting are the following. We can, for instance, incorporate the projection constraints of some of our M's or not, and ask how this affects the number of states at the end. And then another question is, okay, we know that for large black holes, we expect that there will be an asymptotic behavior which is linear. There is going to be also the logarithmic correction according to the analytical countings. But we don't know exactly for how large the black hole, how large has should be the black hole before we start seeing this behavior. I mean, can we have, do we have very chaotic and unpredicted and fluctuating behavior in this regime, or do we get very quickly something which behaves very much like what we expect in the large area regime? Can we say anything about the Sparrow-Mills parameter? I mean, if we find that there is some nice behavior of the entropy for small black holes, and then we can check whether we make contact with the analytical calculation that does or has the same assumptions as we are having now. And here, as I was stressing, we could have done it with the other countings, and we could ask the same questions independently of the counting. And then the question is also what happens with the entropy area relation for small black holes? Is there anything like we could have imagined or not? Is there something new there? And another question is whether this is interesting or not, but we can ask all these questions. So next slide. So the first one is that we know from the analytical calculations that the linear term is unaffected by the imposition of the projection constraint. And this is true for any of the countings. That means that if we forget about this, what it means is that the linear term, which affects the Barbero-Emilsi parameter, is going to be the same independently of whether we consider or not the imposition of this constraint. This only will affect the subleading terms in the counting. So what we did is we told the computer to compute with and without this projection constraint, and what we got was the following plot, which is in the next slide, number 15. So the plot on the upper one is it's the logarithm of the number of states for the given area. The area is in Planck units, so we can only go as far as 150 Planck areas just because of the computing time that takes each of these points to be computed. That's our limitation here. And so the straight line that is a little bit shaky, but it looks like a straight line, is without considering the imposition of the projection constraint. We are taking an interval around the classic or the given classical value to be around two Planck areas, about two in Planck units. I will talk about numbers and everything should be meant in Planck units. And then the other curve, which is rather oscillatory and shaky, so to speak, is when we impose the projection constraint. So we see that there are much less states, of course, when we impose these constraints, and it looks as if the curve was shifted downward. So then the question is, we should expect, at least from the analytical countings, go to next slide. In the analytical computations, this is the general form, which is the first term is linear and the other one has a logarithm term with the, here the important thing is the coefficient minus 1/2. That means that if we subtract the computation with and without the imposition of the constraint, we should get the logarithm part of the behavior. So what we did was to subtract the two previous graphs that we had, the plots, and we found the following, which is in the next slide, number 17. And what we find is something which is oscillatory and it becomes more regular, so to speak. At the end, it looks like a very regular oscillatory function. Here we have, first we had only a few points, later on we feed it with much precision. So these oscillatories are really there. I mean, there are points which are lying on all these curves, and this is an interpolation of all these points. And what we see is that the general tendency of this oscillatory function follows very closely this straight continuous line, which is the minus one half the logarithm. So we do see that these two terms, with and without, these two countings with and without the imposition of the constraint, follows on average what one expects to find in the analytical countings, which is the logarithm correction. So this and this gives also the of course the correct coefficient, but there is still these oscillations, and they don't seem to be going down in amplitude as we go to larger and larger areas. Somehow one might expect that they somehow become less relevant. Of course, we only have very small range up to 150 Planck areas, but there is at least there's no evidence that they go to zero. Okay, so next slide. Okay, so we analyze then the nature of these oscillations. They are there, and the things that we can vary in our countings are the size delta of the interval used in the condition for the area, and we have tried with several numbers, and what we see is that when we increase the number delta, which means that we are making these windows larger and larger, so we can we expect that somehow this behavior gets smoothened out, and this is true. But we see that these oscillations, as we increase delta, they decrease in amplitude, but the period of the oscillation is always constant. It's not unexpected, and I will come back to these oscillations later. As I was telling, we could ask about what happens with the Mirchi parameter. So what we did is, once we checked that the behavior with and without the projection constraint is very much like what happens, what one expects in the large area limit, in the sense that it seems that the linear term is independent of the imposition or not of the projection constraint. So what we did is to compute without the projection constraint, and doing that we can go to much larger black holes, up to 550 Planck areas. And just by looking at the relation between entropy and area for those larger black holes in this case, and asking that the Hawking-Bekenstein relation be satisfied, then we can ask what is the value of the Mirchi parameter that implements this. And what we found is the following, which is on the next slide. We did this for different values of the Mirchi parameter. So we computed all these points and the slope and so on up to 550 Planck areas, and we did that for several values of the Mirchi parameter. And here we see that the slope that we expect to get, which is 0.25, is by interpolating the curve, and then when computing exactly which is the one that fits best, is around 2.274, which is a number, and next slide, this is the number gamma naught. This is the analytical number found in the analytical counting when the same assumptions were taking as the ones we're considering here. And so we see that we do get, even for these small black holes, a very good approximation of the analytical number. And we see then also that on average there are these oscillations, but on average the difference between these two countings behaves in the right way with the logarithmic correction. Okay, so the next question is, can we learn something from these oscillations, or is there any physical meaning to them? And then we can go to next slide. So for that, what we did was to explore what we call the black hole entropy spectrum, which means that instead of taking an interval delta, which was of the order of 2 or 5 in Planck units, we now take a very, very small number, which means that we don't expect to get many points in each of these intervals. Before, if we take an interval of the order of a Planck of 1, we do expect to get many states in there, and that's what we do. And somehow, this is the ordinary standard arguments, that somehow this argument in the large thermodynamic limit will not be that relevant. We are not in that limit, so this is not a surprise that this is important, the size of this. So for why did we choose this small number? Well, what we are doing is just to subdividing the interval of areas in these small regions, because we're taking steps of 0.01, and then the interval is 1/2 of that. So basically, so what we are doing is counting how many states are in each of these small regions in the whole interval for the areas. There's no overlap between these intervals we are considering. In the other cases, there was lots of overlap because we're moving the classical value A0 a little bit, and we are considering a large delta, so there's an overlap between one interval and the next one. In this case, there is none. And then the question is, how many states are in each of these small intervals? Okay. And this is what we found. Next slide, 22. So this is the general plot starting from 10 Planck areas up to 140, which is the range that we have. And this looks like a rather chaotic plot. But if we go and see at the small region in the area, which is the next slide, 23, we see this weird pattern. Here we are only looking from 100 to 114 in Planck areas. And we see these patterns which are periodic and have this, well, strange behavior, so to say. So it turns out that the frequency of these patterns is precisely the frequency that we saw in the entropy when we consider large intervals. And next slide. And this frequency, which we call delta A naught, is roughly of 2.41 in Planck units. And so we can ask whether there is some significance to this periodicity. And so what we did is, okay, maybe this scale or this number given by the periodicity is telling us something. So we decided, okay, why don't we take in computing the entropy, the interval to be given precisely by this number, such that the size of the interval is given by this value, okay? And then if we choose this particular value, what we see is the following. I mean, in all the other cases, we always saw some oscillatory behavior for the entropy, but for this particular choice, we found the following, which is next slide. So here, of course, the pattern has the same periodicity as before. But now when we go and look at the details, which are on the next slide, 26, we see that instead of having something oscillatory, we do have a behavior which is very much like a step. There are regions in which the entropy is practically constant, and then in a very small region there's a kind of a jump. Okay, this is not exactly, but very much approximated. So we do have regions, as I was saying, in which there is no change for the entropy and while we change the area. So this is somehow quite unexpected, at least for us. We're not expecting to find something like this. And this Well, it's subject to many interpretations or further studies, but at least one immediate interpretation, which is go to next slide, is that as I was saying, the entropy seems to be increasing in some discrete steps, and then we ask what is the height of these steps, and they seem to approximate. As we go to the larger values of area that we can reach, seems to approximate to some constant value, and in a sense it is implementing, in an approximate sense of course, the conjecture that Bekenstein had many years ago that the entropy should be equidistant in discrete equidistant steps for large black holes. And so this is the first observation, that there's this behavior which is consistent with this conjecture that Bekenstein had many years ago about the entropy, the spectrum of the entropy. And we could also ask, is there any magic numbers or this coincidence that we had before for instance, this coincidence that led to this boom on quasi-normal mode? And then the answer is, well, this maybe, of course, we don't have any proof or anything. It just happens that the period of the oscillations are the period we need to ask to take this interval in the entropy to get this ladder-like behavior. This depends on gamma, of course, if we have done it for several values of gamma. And the last equation is telling us the approximate form of this, or an approximated analytical form for this, the numbers we're seeing, which depends linearly on the emissivity parameter, and there is this logarithm of 3, which appears there. Of course, I have no proof that this is like this, but this is similar to what happened with the quasi-normal modes, that there was some numerical evidence, and then somebody noted that this number was very close to logarithm of 3. Okay, so next slide. And then as I was telling, we saw that the entropy was approaching a constant number, the value that takes that are the height of these steps approximate the constant number as far as we can tell from our simulations, and this number is given by 2 times gamma naught log 3. This gamma naught is the value of the Mirsky parameter that implements Hawking-Bekenstein condition for large black holes. So this is more like an observation. I don't have a very physical understanding of this. So the natural question is, are these just simple coincidences, or is this the tip of an iceberg? We don't know, and we hope that we will clarify this and other issues that are there. So let me then just go to the next slide and conclude. And remember, main motivation here was what happens if we look at this other regime for isolated horizons, quantum isolated horizons, that were originally meant to make sense only for the large regime, the classical regime. And somehow we find this condition or these oscillations that were, well, I don't know if expected or unexpected, that depends on each one, but at least there's some regularity going there. We see that for small black holes in the not very far from the Planck regime, we do get some behavior that is consistent with the asymptotic large area behavior, and we can even say something about this logarithmic correction, which is the first part, but we see that the relation is much more richer. We found this periodicity, which is puzzling, so to support it some way, and this has this conjecture strange relation to these numbers. And there's some unexpected contact with this heuristic Bekenstein model of equidistant entropy in large black holes. But this comes in a very subtle and convoluted way, so to speak. Instead of just postulating that the black holes have this behavior and therefore there's some spectrum, equidistant spectrum for area, which was what Bekenstein did and many of the people around him. We found this behavior in coming from very, very different approach with a very different area spectrum and counting. And then the question is there more? Can we, for instance, say something or learn something or have something to say about Hawking radiation and these kind of processes? Well, we don't know. So I will just leave it. Bibliography and thank you.
Questions?
Yes, I will comment. I made these comments to Alex a couple of weeks ago, some of them, maybe, but he can might have thought about them and might comment on them. The first is that even if the small black holes looked at areas up to about 150 Planck length square, that corresponds to black hole mass, about 7 Planck masses. Now, if you really have a realistic black hole, which is about 7 Planck mass, then Hawking effect, and if you believe in quantum field theory in curved space-time, which you may not want to, then the Hawking effect would say that it's incredibly fast. It's very, very hot, about 1/7 of the Planck temperature. And therefore, it's evaporating extremely rapidly, and it cannot really be looked at in any sense as an isolated or equilibrium black hole. And therefore, for such small black holes, it is not clear to me that even the notion of equilibrium makes sense, and certainly the notion of entropy may make sense, but it is some notion which is very sophisticated, a little more sophisticated, which has to do with non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. But certainly something like that, you know, isolated horizon, quantum horizon, boundary condition, etc., doesn't make sense. So given this, it's not clear to me that we should be, from a physics perspective, it's not clear to me that we should be looking at formula for entropy that came from isolated horizon perspective for small black holes. Now, having said that, it is often the case that, you know, things work well beyond the domain of applicability of the approximation that was used in the derivation of a result. So I'm not at all saying that these coincidences are useless or they don't say anything at all. They may well say something, but it seems to me that there is no real physical justification to believe, a priori physical justification to believe that we should get something physical and non-trivial by looking at the small black holes. And the example that I would like to give is really, because it is rather similar to this, mathematics would be rather similar, would be just a gas of diatomic molecules, like carbon monoxide, for example. And one can look at its vibrational spectrum, is a bunch of simple harmonic oscillator. And then one can look at its rotational spectrum, more interesting, which looks like precisely the angular momentum, L into L plus 1, et cetera, et cetera. And one could look at, does it make sense to talk about our entropy of, you know, just 150 molecules, or maybe even 7 molecules. And there probably is some periodicity, et cetera, in the number of states with a given energy. And is there some physical meaning to that? And it seems to me that if I could understand this for some simple system like a diatomic molecule, then I would understand, at least have some beginning of physical understanding of this for black holes. Alex.
Okay, thanks. So I should say that I agree that a priori one doesn't expect that in this regime, which is far from the original motivation, one should have something that works. But I have to disagree. In the sense of this Hawking radiation, because we know, quote unquote, that these small black holes should radiate and evaporate very fast for this small value of the mass, because we somehow extrapolate the relation between temperature and energy, which tells us that the smaller the black hole, the larger the temperature. But again, since we are very far from the classical domain in which these classical relations are valid, we don't know for sure what the relation between temperature and mass, energy and area and so on, will be as we go from larger black holes to the Planck regime. And of course, we're only looking at the very, very small region near zero, so to speak, and probably what one should do is go the other way and see whether these relations are satisfied, and we don't know what we will find. I mean, this, we don't know exactly what, for instance, the temperature we can assign is going to behave exactly as predicted by the classical theory or not. And there's a second comment on this point, that even normally there is also a tension with the assumption that there is an horizon at equilibrium, with the fact that that at least from the classical relations, these black holes have negative specific heat. So one normally does something else to make sense of this black hole in equilibrium and so on. So we should, I think, explore or be more, from the beginning say that this will not make sense, because, as I was saying, we don't know exactly what will happen to these relations as we go down to the Planck regime. And the other point about this, the analysis of simple systems, it is true that that something like that may happen in other systems, and I'm sure that it could be that some behavior like this is found, and that's why I didn't want to say that these relations that we are finding are truly deeply significant, but they must just point to something which may be there.
Well, it seems to me that we don't have to believe quantum field theory in curved space-time. I agree with Alex that there is no a priori reason to believe this, at least in this domain. But if we are going to believe that the formula for the entropy is correct, and in fact there is quote-unquote some counting that was done, which supposed that one gets this formula, then one could just use thermodynamics coming from this entropy to conclude the temperature. In other words, we don't have to believe Hawking effect, but we could just look at thermodynamic arguments to, after all, we are using thermodynamic arguments to talk about entropy to calculate temperature, and you'll get exactly the same answer. Well, up to some small fluctuations that may be there in the quantum regime, on average, you would get exactly the same answer as in the laws of classical black hole mechanics. But again, I just want to say that it's perfectly fine to ignore such things and just to pursue and to see if there are some magic numbers and something that comes up which suggests some deeper structure. I think there's no reason to think that, it often happens in physics that things are applicable way beyond the domain of their validity. So that may well be the case here.
Yeah, I agree. Any other questions?
Okay, shall we thank Alex again?